This episode is brought to you by Curie Briefs, the smartest 3-minute read in medicine. Think of it like mental floss for busy clinicians. Sharp, concise, and clinically relevant. Check it out today at Curie.md. And now, on to the show.
Coming up on Curie, what does it really mean to live healthcare from both sides of the bed rail? Today's guest has been there twice. Jacob Kendall is the founder of The Smart Patient, a health advocacy and education group dedicated to helping people and families become savvier, more empowered participants in their care. But before he was advocating for patients, Jacob was one. At 34, he underwent his second open heart surgery, and he's also served as a full-time caregiver for his own family members, navigating the healthcare system's endless handoffs and hard choices. Jacob's experience, equal parts patient, caregiver, and interdisciplinary health pro, gave rise to his 4D health framework, a call to move past one-dimensional, siloed medicine and embrace the messy, multidimensional reality of real people's lives. In this episode, we dig into what that looks like for clinicians, for patients, and for a healthcare system where 15-minute appointments and fragmented care are the norm. If you've ever wondered how to make a difference at the bedside or beyond, stick around. This is Curie. Dr. Jacob Kendall, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. And you can call me just Jacob. That's fine.
Sounds good. Well, Jacob, I'm really excited to have you on because I think you're someone who has lived healthcare from both sides. And you've been, from past conversations that I've heard, you've been very, very outspoken about your experiences as a patient. And I understand that you've gone through two open heart surgeries yourself, but you've also been a caregiver for multiple family members navigating serious health conditions. And so I think your level of firsthand experience operating on both sides of the healthcare spectrum, being a caregiver, but also a recipient of healthcare, I think is unique. And so before we dive into maybe some of the broader themes that will color our discussion today, I thought a good place to start is with just sharing a bit about some of these personal experiences you've had on both sides of the spectrum of care. And sharing some of these key moments that have kind of shaped your understanding of the healthcare landscape.
For sure, yeah. Whenever I, you know, the elevator speech or getting on one of these calls or whatever the case, I never know the best thing to start my leading foot because I have the professional background in social work, public health, gerontology. I just completed a theology degree. But of course, the fact that I've had two open heart surgeries, I'm only 39, is also really interesting to people. So I never know it's the better starting point. Yeah, so you asked about the personal stuff. Aortic valve disease runs rampant in my mom's side of the family. And that explains why I've had to have a surgery at all. The first surgery I chose was the Ross procedure, and it was kind of a complicated procedure. It's all tissue valves, and unfortunately, that one did not last as long as it. I was hoping almost 6 years. So now I have a mechanical valve, and then you really can't have too many of these things. I don't want to have to get another one. I had that at 34, and I went through a lot of anxiety over that. And I have overall complex medical needs, have various other things going on. I advocate for people who are dealing with chronic disease or who are caregivers of folks with complex needs. And I have been a caregiver. My main thing was my dad had a debilitating stroke and heart attack, and my wife and I had plans to move to another state. We had just gotten married, but when that happened to him, I could not leave my mom to care for him on her own. So we moved back to, instead of moving to the other place, we moved back to my home state of Alabama. We're in Alabama right now to help with that. And it's a good thing my wife had a great full-time job. She still does. Because I had to spend, it was pretty much full-time for me dealing with his care. hiring sitters, his rehab, selling their house and possessions, and power of attorney, dealing with all the different pieces of that. The caregiving is, it does not happen in a vacuum. It affects every part of your life. You know, you go through things like this and you gain a lot of wisdom, but good Lord, that is expensive wisdom, and I'm just trying not to waste it. So that's why I combine my personal and professional backgrounds to do health advocacy.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by how some of these personal experiences can color and shape our professional philosophies. And in a nutshell, I think you can describe, you know, any individual kind of as the sum of their experiences and decisions and life events. And, you know, in that introduction, you kind of described yourself as interdisciplinary. And I know that you like to draw from all various sectors of life, including biology and social work and public health and even theology to a certain extent. And you use all of these different forces to understand and interpret healthcare. And so I was wondering if you could just kind of shed a little bit more light on that interdisciplinary approach and how you even arrived at this kind of broader, multifaceted way of thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you asked about that. You know, I mentioned when I first started talking a few minutes ago that I don't ever know what the best leading thing about me is, but I always say early on that one of the most important thing, the most important thing to me professionally, is being interdisciplinary. It's a very academic term. When I got my PhD, I thought I was going to retire professor. I was a professor for several years. Maybe multidimensional, polymath. I've been trying to find the right term that travels well beyond academia. But the basic thing is, you know, it was a childhood dream of mine to be a true women's science person. I much prefer to be a jack of all trades than an expert of one. And listen, we need experts. I'm really damn glad that the people who did my valve surgeries are really, 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 really good at valve surgeries. I want that. But I think that all settings, including healthcare, need more interdisciplinary folks. So it's just kind of runs through my blood, to along with my blood thinner that I have to take. It's a part of my core being to be interdisciplinary. I really love connecting the dots between different silos. Let's just take aging. My PhD is technically in interdisciplinary aging studies. That's way too many syllables, so I'd say gerontology. That's the definition of gerontology anyway, an interdisciplinary study of aging. And we learned about aging from the perspective of fill in the blank, anything that's related to aging: molecular biology, genetics, neuroscience, endocrinology, biostats, epidemiology, demography, history, law, ethics, architecture, etc. And that's what I love. And they told us coming out of that program that the number one skill we would have is how to bridge the bridge, create that bridge, facilitate the dialogue across those different things. And so, you know, typically when you meet someone who's focused on aging, it's in a particular area like ageism or senior living or retirement or chronic disease or end of life. I like to be the bridge across those things, right? We live in a very siloed world. Academia siloed, the psychology department, the history department, the school of medicine, et cetera. Within medicine, it's very siloed. And how many patients have talked about how their different specialists are not communicating with one another? And as a business owner, it's also very siloed. Choose your one solution, your one audience, the one problem you're solving for them. I'm just so tired of things operating that way. Like, it doesn't have to be that way. And so I very much push a more interdisciplinary and multidimensional way of solving these problems. Again, not everyone has to be interdisciplinary, but enough of us should be. And everything from government to healthcare to academia should be hiring more interdisciplinarians, right? I think I answered your question, but let me know if not.
Absolutely. And I think this is a really good segue into the four-dimensional health framework that you've created. And I want to talk a little bit more about what it is and why you created it. And hopefully I didn't bury the lead here. But, you know, for our listeners, could you help us unpack this 4D health framework that you have created, this 4D health framework of yours? What exactly are these four dimensions? Why is it important that we have four dimensions? And why did you feel that it was necessary to even create this framework or create this model?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great segue because that's what it built from. And honestly, I say create it. I'm not creating it from scratch. I'm creating it based on the observations that I've had amidst all my professional experiences and training, et cetera. And I have no formal training in physics, but I have an amateur personal love for quantum mechanics. And the four dimensions are the same as four dimensions of space-time, three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. And if you think about, this is hard for me to do without an actual visual. I know social workers will know what I'm talking about with Bronfenbrenner's ecological framework. But basically, if you can imagine the concentric circles on the very on a sheet of paper, right? In the very center, you'll see an individual, and then the next one out is family, and the next one out is community, and the next one out is larger population or whatever. And you have these concentric circles. I think those are really good frameworks, but they're incomplete because they're flat. They're just on a two-dimensional sheet of paper, but the world doesn't operate that way. We live in four dimensions. I just think that we're applying one-dimensional solutions to four-dimensional problems. And so the four dimensions are scale. So, you know, we live in American individualism has run amok. We think of everything in terms of the individual liberty. Well, I don't want to support policies for people who are obese because they just choose to eat too much. Well, that's not true. These are systemic public health issues with factors that are happening at higher levels. So we need to be willing to zoom out to more macro levels to understand health, right? If we only focus on the individual, on that unit of analysis, we're not going to fully understand things. The second dimension is different disciplinary perspectives. Like our government hires many economic advisors and political scientists, but why do they not hire anthropologists or epidemiologists or historians or biostatisticians or sociologists or demographers? Why do they hire these other people to have all these other disciplines? At many universities, medical schools get all the attention. That's like the cash cow for universities, and that's the respect that that they get. And that's great and everything, but those are not the only perspectives to have. So here we have, I meant to say at the beginning, I represent this 4D framework with one phrase. Health is more than individual, medical, here and now. Okay, so it's more than individual. I just mentioned that one a moment ago. And then the second one is more than medical. We need more than just physicians and nurses' perspectives on health. It's much more than that. If all you do for your health is do what your doctor or nurse says, then you're not going to be as healthy as you possibly can be. The next one is medical is more than here, right? And this is where we start getting interesting with comparing different geographic locations. So I live in an area. We moved here in 2021, and is one of the fastest growing counties in the country. It's the seventh fastest growing metro area in the entire country down here in Baldwin County, Alabama. And I always have, given my needs, I had to establish myself with providers right when I move somewhere, especially primary care, cardiology, and dentistry. Okay. And it didn't take me long because of that. It didn't take me long to start seeing like, whoa, there are issues with healthcare access here. I'm having to schedule my appointments out months in advance. Right. And it was easy for me to be frustrated with the doctors. But after a while, I started to realize, no, this is not their fault. You can't drive 5 minutes in any direction here and not see evidence of the population growth because neighborhoods and apartment complexes are growing up rapidly. And so I realized this is an issue of healthcare access. I live in a fast growing area and more people are moving here and we're straining the infrastructure, including healthcare access. And I started talking to my providers about that and they agree. Many of them having to close their doors, they can't accept new patients. And so, you know, if I have a stroke, I'm at high risk of stroke because I'm on blood thinning medications. If I have a stroke, I gotta have care right then and there. And if we don't have, you know, if the ER is overfilled or whatever, that's potentially life threatening for me. And so we've been talking about moving to another place that has a lot of amenities, but where their healthcare system is not strained. And you got to think about those things. You can't possibly understand them though. Until you zoom out a little bit and look at you know, the bigger picture. And I was a global health professor, so I could get super nerdy with you and compare things between different countries. I won't go there here now, but I'm just letting you know it's more than just here, okay? And then finally, it's more than just now. We are absolutely terrible as Americans at planning in advance. I think people, as soon as they get married or as soon as they hit you know, get their job as an adult, they need to go ahead and be thinking about life insurance, planning their estates, getting wills, getting power of attorney. If they have children, then be thinking about who's going to take those children if you die, and even start planning for your funeral and put money aside for those things. But we don't plan for these things until the crisis hits. as a gerontologist, I see this all the time, and families can be torn apart because of it. We have to be thinking about our health care in a longer view than just what's going on here and now. We just don't do that very well. I'm trying to get quicker explaining it, summarizing the 4D model, but those are the four dimensional models. Those are the four dimensions of this 4D model. And I think that the healthcare system needs to be taking these more into account, because we have an incredibly inefficient healthcare system. We spend way more than any other country, but we have lower life expectancy than half of them.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about how physicians can apply this four-dimensional model in practice, because I think a lot of healthcare providers really resonate with the idea and with the concept of treating a patient in a very holistic sense. But in practice, we know that time constraints and administrative burdens and specialization often limit this ideal of being able to kind of practice in a very holistic, comprehensive manner. And, you know, I was doing some research and saw that I think according to some recent surveys, the average patient visit is just 15 minutes long. So not much time to really discuss all four of these dimensions of health. So in a practical sense, how do you recommend healthcare providers realistically integrate 4D thinking into their everyday practice, given some of these real world limitations and constraints?
Absolutely. I did a, it's a great question, and a lot of people ask this. Well, first of all, let me say, I'll back up a little bit from where I was about to start. And I'm not going to sit here and sugarcoat anything. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend that every single person who's an healthcare provider should care about all of these different dimensions. I think that everyone has their particular niche. What I'm saying is, I think that even if we zoom out a little bit more, even if we consider a little bit more of this dimension, that things can be better. So let me give you a couple of examples. I recently did a two-part talk with a group of first year residents for internal medicine at a hospital. And I knew that I was going to do two parts. And when I did the first one, I introduced this model. And one thing that I kept bringing up is social workers. I have a social work degree, and so that's always something I'm going to mention. And, you know, social workers commonly work in hospitals. They're usually known as medical social workers, and they're the ones that are handling discharge. Hey, if you got to go to rehab, let me set that up for you. Or if you're going home, but you need some help being cared for at home, let me help you with that. Oh, you can't get to the bank or to the pharmacy, let me set up transportation for you and those things. And so I mentioned that, like, you know, I think the social workers should be considered more central, and more their opinion should be valued on the interdisciplinary medical teams, but they're not. They're paid less, and they're usually kind of cast off to the side with their opinions not being as important. I mentioned this, then someone brought up the question at the end of this, my first talk, and they said, well, that sounds all great, but we work in a hospital in a city that cannot afford social workers. We have these caseworkers, but they're not well-trained, and they're not, you know, they're overworked, and they're not able to fill all these things. So I thought about that, and when I did my second talk, I had to account for that fact, and I gave them some simple things like, hey, these are some really simple things that you can do since they don't have social workers telling them. And, you know, it was things like, you know, asking simple questions like, do you live alone? Do you have someone who cares for you? Hey, the next time you go to an appointment, bring your caregiver with you. Make sure you put your appointments in your phone. I mean, really, really simple things. I just completed a booklet of 51 everyday tips for people who are living with a mechanical heart valve like I have. And these are things that I've learned on my own. No provider has ever told me any of these things. I'm working on a second book, and then I'm going to work on a third one. I already have the ones lined up I'm going to work to, and every single thing I'm putting in them, I didn't learn from a provider. Simple things like when you're checking out from your appointment and they're like, hey, when do you want to have your next appointment? And they hand you a card. Do not leave until you have put that in your phone while still standing at the desk and set an alert, an alarm reminder. Set daily alarms to take your medications, because that decreases noncompliance. Why do providers never say these really simple things? Because you can decrease noncompliance or non-adherence, and you can decrease people missing their appointments, which saves them money and time from not having to deal with that and not having to call people. And I mentioned caregivers especially. Why does no one ever say, hey, bring your caregiver with you? Why have my mom's doctors never told her to bring me with her? I have to go to her appointments, but why do they not just go ahead and tell her that? Really, really simple things that doesn't take any more of their time. And I mentioned caregivers especially because patients should be the center of their care. You know, we have a hierarchical medical system where the patients are like the in line. It shouldn't be that way. And caregivers and families should be more involved as well. If they can't afford the time to do that, then they should hire people like me who have already created all these resources to do an affiliate partnership. There are really inexpensive, time efficient ways to do all these things. So I'm just giving you a couple of examples there. I think a lot of it is going to boil down to mentioning very simple things that you can recommend to your patients that don't take any more of your time, and they can go a long way toward, you know, helping with a lot of these issues. Another one that I think is really important, I think a key to any doctor's office or department in a hospital, a huge critical piece that I think doesn't get as much attention is the front office staff. They should be trained on basic customer service, on, you know, being nice and compassionate, empathic. There have been so many times in which they've just been rude to me, and I know that they work really hard, and sometimes they get annoyed, but those things matter a lot to patient well-being. When your front office staff or the billing department or whomever treats your patients like they're human beings, that just makes everything better. So I think focusing on what you think are small things that are really not that small of things, right? And listen, I'll mention another one. When I started realizing that the population growth in this area was affecting healthcare access, and I started talking to my providers about this the next time I went in for an appointment, no one disagreed with me. Not a single one disagreed with me about it. Some of them are like, yeah, this is going to be a major concern. And I'm wondering, why the hell did I have to ask about this for you to mention it? Why can't a doctor say, hey, listen, I'm just letting you know, because of population growth here, you're going to have to wait a long time for your appointments. That's such a simple thing to mention, but no one says that, right? So those are just a few ways where even if you just reach out a little bit more into those other dimensions, it can make a huge difference. You don't even have to go that far with it. Listen, they're policymakers, they're public health professionals like me who are going a lot farther with them. I'm not expecting physicians to do that, but just a little bit more can go a long way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I appreciate you providing some, you know, concrete, tangible examples of ways in which communication can break down. And I really resonate with the idea of, you know, patients kind of being at the center of their experience and ultimately having to kind of take the brunt of those communication gaps and kind of needing to act as their own coordinators or even advocates, medical translators, yeah. Right? Kind of reading between the lines. Yeah, advocates, like you mentioned. And there's all different ways in which these coordination and communication challenges can take root. Jacob, one other thing that I've heard you remark on in the past is a shift in how different generations also approach their healthcare decisions.
Yeah.
And, there's this interesting report that I came across, and not to get too technical, but just some interesting stats that really caught my eye. So this is according to the 2025 Edelman Trust Barometer, but they said that 40% of young adults, so those aged from 18 to 34, have said that they have turned to social media for health advice over their doctors. So 40% of those aged 18 to 34 said they turned to social media for health advice over their doctors. And then another 50% believe that the average person can know just as much about health as any trained physician.
Yeah.
And so I think what's really interesting is, you know, you're seeing this younger generation and this is not to harp on the younger generation, because I don't mean that by any means, but I'm just trying to point out maybe some of the generational differences between the two. Yeah. But you see a younger generation that I think is highly networked. It's skeptical maybe of authority and traditional authority.
Yep.
And
yep.
then, you know, heavily influenced from, you know, the content creators that they follow online.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, how have you seen these generational shifts play out? And what do you think this means? What do you think these generational shifts mean for the provider-patient relationship when you have a physician that might be dealing with a geriatric patient versus maybe a younger patient in that 18 to 34 demographic?
Yeah, for sure. As a gerontologist, I have to talk about generational differences. And there are pros and cons to both. You know, I usually, one of the negative things that I talk about is that people in the older generation just unequivocally trust what their doctor says. And I never think that's a good idea, because health is more than medical. It's not that physicians don't know what they're talking about, but they look at medicine from a very particular perspective. And I'm glad that you mentioned social media, because a lot that I'm in, I think, three different Facebook groups related to valve replacement in some way. People who are on blood thinners, people who have had their aortic valve replaced. And I'm on Facebook, like those are on Facebook, and I see them come up on my feed, and I contribute to them. If I can give a positive answer or a helpful answer, I do that. But I also ask questions, and I learn so much that way. You know, that there's this product called Bleed Stop, because we're at higher risk of bleeding, right? If I get a cut on my hand, I can use this stuff. You can buy it on Amazon. No provider ever told me about that. I learned about this by being on social media. And I understand that providers, for some reason, for good reasons, they're probably hesitant about recommending to their patients, hey, you might want to join a few support groups or join a few social media groups, because they're not providing medical advice. But I think that they should be more open to it, and it should just come with a disclaimer. Hey, you might find it helpful to be talking to other people who've had your experiences. Or if they recommend some certain products that are helpful, like, that's okay, because physicians can't be expected to know that. But obviously it can go too far in one direction. And this is where I think things should be synergistic rather than antagonistic. You know, I don't know if I'm using the right terms. They should work with one another rather than against one another. And the providers who I have are the best are the ones that live by the principle, be curious, not judgmental. So I have a neurologist, and I said, dude, I've been to physical therapy. I've been to a spinal surgeon. I've been to a pain doctor, and I just cannot get rid of my back pain. And he said, just go swimming. Swim regularly. If I go swimming, that doesn't help him out at all. He doesn't get any money for that, but he's willing to tell me this little extra thing. It's not even medical advice. That's just some kind of common sense thing. Why did none of those other physicians tell me that, right? I think that physicians need to be willing to, and this is changing. And you indicated that earlier. I think physicians are increasingly realizing that health is whole body or whole person. It's not just biomedical. But there's still too many who are not willing to say things like that and think outside the box and be curious rather than judgmental. So I can fully understand why younger generations have come to be skeptical of institutional medicine and really institutional anything. I can get it. We know that that's a reality. And I think that healthcare providers need to realize that that's the case, and they need to meet their audience where they are. Okay, so yeah, and listen, you didn't even mention ChatGPT or AI. People are going to that for medical advice now, and diagnoses and therapy. And that could be really, really dangerous, but it's not going to slow down. It's not going to stop. You can't just tell someone, don't go looking any of this up on social media. Don't go using AI for any of this, because people are going to do it. So I think the healthcare providers need to learn to work with that rather than against it. I don't know if I answered your original question, but whatever you ask, all of that I just said is what came to mind.
No, I really appreciate that perspective. And I actually want to park on this topic just for a little bit longer, because I think there's some valuable insights in there about being curious and not judgmental. And, you know, with some of these technological advances, I think physicians are dealing with experiences that maybe they didn't necessarily come across in their medical yeah. training. Like you talked about the rise and influence of patients using ChatGPT to look up their symptoms or even self-diagnose. And then we also spoke about maybe some of the challenges around communication with generational shifts and differences in patient age demographics. From your perspective, are there any other actions that clinicians can take right now to help bridge these communication gaps and better support patients? I'm curious if you have any other tips or advice beyond what you shared about being curious and not judgmental.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing that my favorite providers do is they're willing to go a little bit extra, go a little bit of the extra mile. I received they discovered I'm very open about my own health because I want to normalize chronic disease. Microhemorrhage is in my brain a couple of years ago, and the first neurologist I saw, the diagnosis she gave, and she was absolutely certain that it was this one thing, was terrible. It was a terrible day of my life. Then I consulted my cardiologist, started looking up to see if there could be another explanation, and he found this like article from Australia, and he contacted the author of that article, and then he got me in really quickly with a neurologist that he likes, and that neurologist gave me a much better diagnosis that so far has been proven by tests and makes a hell of a lot more sense. And those two providers were a lot more curious. So, I mean, just being willing to think a little bit outside the box and don't automatically think that your surefire answer is exactly that. I mean, does it take that much more time to pick up the phone every now and then and say, hey, I have this patient, blah-de-blah-de-blah, what's your insight on it, or whatever. I know it takes a little bit more time, but ultimately, in the long run, I think it actually saves time. Another thing is, I have an entire section in the booklet that I told you about how to take notes. I use the Notes app on my iPhone, and I have a different note for each provider. And the second that I think of a question I want to ask them next time, I mark it down with a bullet point. And then when I go in, I ask them that question, and I check it off, and I put the response to it below that in the note. So what? No provider has ever told me to do this, but most of them see me looking on my phone, and they say, I really appreciate that you came in with these specific questions. So I think that they mostly appreciate when we do that. Why not mention to your patients, hey, if you go look on ChatGPT or if you're in your Facebook group and you ask about this and there's something that comes up that you had not heard before or that I haven't told you, go ahead and write that down, and then you can ask about it next time when we have an appointment. I want to hear about it. Like, encourage them to work with them on that. Don't simply say, don't listen to anything that WebMD says. No, if something comes up and you want to know more about it, and if it's something that you haven't heard from me, write it down and let's talk about it next time. Okay? I mean, just really simple as that. Why has no physician ever told me to take notes when I'm out there in between appointments when something comes to mind? Because then that appointment is going to be a lot more efficient if I'm being specific, precise, and I'm taking notes. I'm not going to remember all the questions that I need to between appointments. I mean, there's sometimes 6, 12 months apart, right? And patients go into the office and they're like, oh, well, everything's fine. And then they leave the office 10 minutes later. They're like, ah, damn, I should have asked this question. I forgot. Just eliminate those problems. And a provider can simply say, whatever you learn, I know that you're going to go out there and look this up on. You're going to ask ChatGPT about this. You're going to look this up. You're going to ask your friends in your support group, whatever. If you learn about something, write it down. We'll talk about it next time. That doesn't take any more of their time, and they're embracing the fact that they know that their patients are going to do those things anyway. So why not work with it rather than against it? I think I answered your question.
Super simple. I want to pivot, actually, and talk a little bit more about your work when it comes to healthcare advocacy, because, you know, one thing that I've learned or one thing that I've enjoyed learning about you, Jacob, in doing some of the research for this interview is, you know, how vocal and passionate and actively engaged you are on the front lines of healthcare advocacy. And I think healthcare advocacy, especially in a system that is fraught with its issues and as complicated as we've been litigating on this episode, I think healthcare advocacy can feel a little bit overwhelming or even defeating at times. And so I wanted to ask, you know, what keeps you motivated to stay involved, to continue advocating despite maybe some of these complexities and some of these challenges of the healthcare system?
Yeah, for sure. So remember that the first dimension of that 4D model is health is more than individual. I'm not talking about zooming out to larger units analysis. Of course, I could talk about zooming in as well, and we should be doing that, but I'm not a laboratory scientist. I'm super intrigued by cellular medicine, quantum medicine, so we can zoom in as well. But I'm a public health professional, so I'm all about zooming out. Oh my goodness, I lost my train of thought. State your question again.
What keeps you motivated to stay involved and to continue advocating for healthcare advocacy, even amidst maybe some of the complexity and challenges of our healthcare system?
So when I'm talking about zooming out to larger units analysis, inevitably the question that comes up is, how are you going to convince health insurance to companies to make these changes? Because ultimately, if you zoom out far enough, you're going to get to the people at the very top. And this is where I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you. Listen, I'm not trying to change insurance companies. I would have to convince billionaires to stop loving money. That's not going to happen. We got to be able to find the balance between those things, right? Where is my sweet spot? Where can I make legitimate differences that don't involve trying to take down a system that's too powerful? I'm not trying to do that. But that doesn't mean that I can't help make life better for the people on the ground. So I want to acknowledge the question you just asked, because it's an excellent one, and that's a really common one I get. No, I'm not trying to convince insurance companies to give a shit about patients, because they don't and they're not going to. That's no point. So what keeps me motivated is not only – so it's a combination. First of all, my personal experiences. Listen, I mentioned earlier – the wisdom and insights that I've gained from my experience as someone who's had two open heart surgeries, who's been a caregiver for multiple people, who has complex medical needs and hundreds of encounters with our healthcare system, that is really expensive wisdom and insight. Frankly, if I could give up that wisdom insight and not have my two heart surgeries, I would. That's really expensive wisdom. I've had to go through a lot to get that. And I don't want to waste it. I don't want it to be just for me. I want to do what I can to use that to try to help other people. That's what keeps me going, is I just don't want to waste that. It's the same thing as being handed $1 million and not letting it sit there. You want to use it for good, right? This is like my $1 million, the wisdom and insight that I've gained. I just don't want to waste it. That combines with the formal knowledge and professional background that I have that affirms, improves, and explains everything in my personal experience. So, does that make sense? These challenges that I've had with health insurance companies, the numbers back that up. There's an explanation for this, right? So those things combined is what keeps me going. I just don't want to waste the experiences that I've had.
As we wrap up here, Jacob, I want to turn directly to, the clinicians and the healthcare professionals listening to this episode. And, it's great hearing how passionate and vocal and motivated you are in your work. And, I think for a lot of clinicians, many entered the field driven by, a sense of purpose. And I think it's safe to say that some may be feeling increasingly frustrated or constrained by the realities of modern healthcare. And hearing you kind of articulate the way in which you're able to reconnect with a sense of purpose, I was wondering if you could offer any final piece of advice, something tangible and practical to help physicians also reconnect with their purpose. What would that final piece of advice be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll say two things. I do think that the seemingly small things can matter. This is the first thing. I just use this as an example. I really try not to tie myself to my degree. I only put my title in there. I debate all the time, when do I use my doctorate and not? I prefer not to use it ever, but certain audiences, it gives me more credence, right? I had this doctor one time, because in the form that I filled out, it asked for my formal title. So instead of Mr., I put doctor. And when they called me back, they said, "Hey, Dr. Kendall." And then when he entered the room, this physician, he said, "Hey, Dr. Kendall." I'm like, "Wow, you really took the time to notice something like that." I noticed that too. The really small things can make a difference. They can. If someone brings a family member, I've had example. I go with my mom to appointments on a regular basis, and I have those providers who don't look me in the eye at all, and they're only talking to my mom. Don't do that. Don't do that. I'm in the room for a reason. You need to engage me as well. Those small things like that, okay? They can go a long way, and they don't take any extra time at all. And I don't know... when I was a professor, I had course evaluations, and so I had a natural way for me to see what my students thought of me. Whenever I got even one or two positive comments, that's what kept me going. I don't know what physicians have in the way of that. I don't think that are like review forms or whatever, but I just think that, like, I make a point of telling my providers whom I really appreciate, like, hey, you're a really good provider and I appreciate that. So I just think that if you do those small things, people are going to show appreciation for it. I want to say something else as well. One thing that I do is help especially social workers who want to pivot to another career because they're just tired of it. They're overworked, they're underpaid, and so they want to pivot. And many of them feel guilty and think that they're abandoning their field. And I can't speak to this as a physician because I've never been a physician. I am a social worker, but I know that there are some medical providers who are like, dang, I just don't know if I can do this anymore. Listen, there's something you can do with your skills and knowledge, and it doesn't necessarily have to be practicing. My best friend is a physician, and he practiced for several years, and now he's more so he teaches interns because he loves teaching. Does he get paid a little bit less for it? Sure, but he's already paid off all his loans, and his family has plenty of money, right? So, like, it's okay to think outside of the box. I don't think that anyone should feel obligated to do this or that particular thing. If you want to go start your own business or be a coach, or you want to switch more to teaching medical students rather than practicing, or, I mean, there are various options out there. I hope that everyone is willing to apply some critical thinking and being willing to think outside the box and push the boundaries of whatever they think they should be doing and not feel guilty for wanting to do that. I think that's okay, and I encourage it. So those are a couple of things I would say to answer your question.
Well, Jacob, this has been great. Thank you so much. It was a fascinating conversation and really appreciate you taking the time to share some of your perspectives.
Great questions you asked. Thanks for doing this work. I'm glad that you're doing this. I appreciate the opportunity just to have a conversation with you.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.